Well, Tesla cars have been around for quite a while now, and they're actually black boxes to us from the point of a software view. So we got Niklas Kühnapfer, Christian Werling, and Hans-Niklas Jakob, and they have actually rooted the autopilot system and the infotainment system, and they're going to present their insights now in their following talk. Please.
Thanks for the introduction and welcome to our talk. I am Christian, and together with Niklas and Hans-Niklas, I will present to you part two of our Tesla hardware hacking efforts. If you've seen the previous talk by Kevin about car forensics, this is the perfect follow-up. Let me first tell you what motivated us to do this research and what you need to know about Tesla Autopilot beforehand. In the second part, Niklas will present the lion's share of this research, analyzing the autopilot's hardware in detail and attacking its secure boot mechanism through voltage glitching. Finally, enabled by our tech, Hans-Niklas is going to present our insights into autopilot internals and how we extracted some very sensitive data from it. Our fault injection efforts date back to 2021, when Hans-Niklas and colleagues introduced a voltage glitching attack on AMD's secure processor, which originally was there to undermine AMD's VM encryption. 1 year later, Hans-Niklas and I extended that work with our fault TPM paper and showed that you cannot really trust TPM-based full disk encryption like BitLocker on AMD laptops and desktops. Meanwhile, Niklas showed that AMD's chips are also prone to electromagnetic fault injection. Earlier this year, we transferred these attacks to Tesla's newest infotainment generation, which happened to be based now on AMD processors. At Black Hat, we presented this jailbreak of the infotainment board, which temporarily even allowed us to get free CTTers. Unfortunately, we are still waiting for Black Hat to upload the recording, but stay tuned. Today, we would like to spare AMD for once, but not so Tesla. While being an advanced driving assistant, Autopilot keeps making headlines for good and bad. Only 2 weeks ago, Tesla Autopilot made the news with a recall of more than 2 million vehicles, which they allegedly performed through a software update. And then there's speculation about hidden and questionably legal features like Elon mode, lifting the requirement to have your hands on the steering wheel. Secondly, while Tesla's infotainment system didn't stand our hardware attacks, its software security seemed very mature. After all, it processes large amounts of personal data about both the driver and it carries Tesla's autopilot software. This is what a modern Tesla's digital architecture roughly looks like. The top half is what you could call the brains of the operation and is contained in one central metal box in the passenger seat area. The gateway in green acts as a hardware firewall between the car's CAN bus and the infotainment system in blue, which we already routed. The autopilot board sits in a special position, being directly connected to the CAN bus as well as the camera array. Let me give you a very rough idea of what Autopilot does. At any time, even if you don't have any assistants engaged, it will take camera and sensor data and create a representation of the world around the car. This representation is on a Tesla even visualized on the center display as if your car wants to brag about its situational awareness. Some of this rich data is logged. The event data recorder that Kevin already mentioned in his previous talk logs the most relevant data points like vehicle speed versus time on a memory in the airbag unit and when the airbag is triggered. Tesla provides an adapter cable and some software to access it. But there's more. On the gateway's SD card, Tesla continuously stores low-resolution CAN data using a proprietary log format. Then, when, for example, the airbag is deployed, a so-called high-resolution log is recorded for a short amount of time, providing more fine-grained information. Both of these proprietary log formats were reverse engineered, and Francis Hochendijk documented those in 2021. You can find his Tesla logs repository on GitHub. Finally, his scripts and documentation also contain some information about the snapshot mechanism used by Autopilot and primarily used for fleet learning. Snapshots can store hundreds of megabytes of data, and Hans Niklas will dedicate the third part of this talk to them. Autopilot developed quite a lot in the past 10 years. While Hardware 1 only had access to one front-facing camera, Tesla has used an 8-camera setup for the longest time. To scan its surroundings, radars and sonars are in use in most models and were improved over the years as well. In order to process all that increasing amount of data, Autopilot's processors evolved from a single Mobileye IQ3 to a mix of NVIDIA and Infineon chips until, in Hardware 3, Tesla introduced their custom silicon FSD chips. Lastly, Autopilot needs a place to store its firmware, including all of its AI, ML magic, and temporary sensor data. Up until Hardware 2.5, this storage was unencrypted, which enabled, for example, Francis or Kevin's peek into the Autopilot. However, since Hardware 3, this storage is encrypted and therefore not readable after desoldering the chip. Only code running on the Autopilot can access it. Which brings me to my final slide that I borrowed from Tesla's Hardware 3 introduction. A security subsystem on their custom FSD chip supposedly, quote, ensures the system only runs code cryptographically signed by Tesla. Challenge accepted, or that's what Niklas thought, who will now guide you through the second part of this talk.
So yeah, I will talk about the hardware analysis and the attack. This is the Autopilot board. As you can see, there are two main socks, namely Turbo A and Turbo B. And around those socks, there are some RAM chips, for example, or an SPI flash, and there is also the universal flash storage right here. An Ethernet switch, here colored in brown, connects both socks and is also used to connect the board to the outside world via automotive Ethernet. Then there are some other peripherals and some connectors for UART, for example, and we can also use those connectors to reset the socks. And the board is also powered through the big connectors. Ah, yeah, and then we soldered our own connector to the board, but we'll talk about this one later. Yeah, this is the backside of the board. As you can see, there are two real-time clocks powered by a small battery, and there are two JTAG connectors, but unfortunately, JTAG is locked with a password. Okay, so this is a die shot of the Tesla full self-driving chip. It's called Turbo, and it's fabricated by Samsung in their 40-nanometer process. They have 12 ARM V8 cores. They are grouped into three clusters, and they run the main operating system. Then they have two neural processing units that handle all the machine learning tasks, and on top of it, you can see a GPU, an image signal processor, and a video encoder that they use for their vision system. What's interesting here is that there are two other cores, a safety system, also called SMS, and this one is used to compare the decision of both turbo nodes, and it should stop dangerous actions based on this comparison. But for us, the most interesting system is the security system, also called SCS. And this one is the first part of the chip that boots and unloads the firmware and releases all the other cores. So most systems store their firmware on a small SPI chip, flash chip, just like the BIOS in your computer, for example. So we have read and analyzed the content of that chip and found a little flash file system. We reverse engineered parts of it. As you can see, it has a flash file system table whose entries point to different files, like all those firmware parts on the bottom of the slide. But we also found a certificate chain that is used to sign all those files. Okay, so looking at the UART bootlogs and the SPI activity, we found out that the SES ROM bootloader is the first code that is executed. And it loads the SES bootloader 1 from SPI flash, verifies its signature, and starts executing it. Bootloader 1 will do mostly the same as it loads bootloader 2 and also verifies it. And bootloader 2 then runs forever, but it also loads and verifies the SMS firmware, as well as the A72 firmware, which consists of core root and the Linux system. We as an attacker would now like to get root access to that system in some way. And the most common way is, to do this is to patch the Linux system. And we would like to do that so that it boots into recovery and so that we can access the system via SSH without a password. But if we do this, this last verification step would fail. So I just mentioned that the SES ROM is able to verify other firmware parts, and we will now have a closer look on how that works. So the trust anchor in the system is the root CA. It is loaded from SPI flash, will then be hashed, and the resulting hash is compared to a hash that is stored in fuses inside the chip. So this certificate is the root of a certificate chain consisting of an issuing authority certificate and the firmware signing certificate. And the key inside the firmware signing certificate is then used to verify other firmware parts, such as the SES bootloader 1, bootloader 2, and all the other stages. Okay, so to be able to re-sign the modified Linux system, we would like to replace the root CA. But then its verification would just fail, and yeah, that's exactly the point where a fault injection attack could help us. So if we can trick the processor into loading our modified root CA, we could also replace the whole certificate chain, and we could re-sign all the other firmware parts, including our modified Linux system. So let's talk about fault injection attacks. Fault injection is a method where an attacker induces faults by altering the IC's environment. We could do this, for example, we could hit an IC, for example, with a laser or with EM radiation. But we could also try to modify the supply voltage. In the case of voltage glitching, the supply voltage is lowered for a very short amount of time, just as you can see on the picture below. So to make this attack happen, we will now create a little plan. Here you can see the autopilot board. It has the FSD chip with all its cores, but we are mostly interested in the SES core. And this SES core is connected to an external SPI flash, and it is properly powered by an external voltage regulator. To attack this system, we plan to use a normal computer and a Teensy microcontroller. Our computer should monitor the bootlog via UART, and it will be used to control the Teensy. The Teensy will then take care about the timing critical parts of this attack, for example, monitoring the SPI activity for the timing of the attack, but it will also interrupt the supply voltage of the SES. But first, we need to find the power supply of the security system. And voltage regulator circuits are quite easy to find because most of the time they consist of a small chip, an inductor, and some capacitors. And if you know these parts, you see that most of the board consists of power circuitry. So we measured all the voltages during boot and found out that most of this is inactive, or it provides a too high voltage, like 3.3 or 5 volts, for example. But apart from this inactive circuitry, there are those two marked circuits here, which are quite interesting. So if we zoom in a little bit, we can see this tiny chip here. Which turned out to be a Texas Instruments voltage regulator. The data sheet is available, and they also provide a reference PCB layout, which you can see here. And all the blue parts are PCB traces, the gray parts are pads of all those components. And if we compare this with the image of the PCB, we can see some similarities. For example, this inductor here, L1, is also there. And also the capacitor C2 seem to be also right here. And this shows us that the output of the power supply that we would like to interrupt is right here between the inductor and the capacitors. So we now know where we have to interrupt the power. So here you can see the voltage regulator that always tries to keep the voltage as stable as possible on the left side. Then there are some capacitors in the middle that buffer some energy for mostly the same reason. And our first idea now was to interrupt the power by just shorting the voltage rail. This type of glitching circuit is quite common and is called a crowbar circuit. And to do this, we will use our Teensy microcontroller that monitors the SPI activity. But we have also added a MOSFET that works just like a little switch. And we can control this MOSFET using our Teensy. So if we turn this MOSFET on, it connects the voltage rail to ground. And the result of this is that most of the current flows directly to ground and not through the SCS. But both the voltage regulator and the capacitor will still try to hinder us from this. So some current is coming from the capacitors, and that's why we decided to remove them. So this is the front side of the board, and we desoldered those capacitors here, but there was no big difference in the voltage drop we created. So after measuring around multiple times, we found another capacitor on the back side that was a little bit hidden, but quite big. Yeah, so we also had to remove that one. Unfortunately, the voltage drop still seemed to be not steep enough, so we decided to also cut the connection of the voltage regulator that still tries to keep the voltage up. And we do this with another MOSFET. So, yeah, if you're interested in the complete circuit, you can have a look at this diagram later. We also added a MOSFET driver IC to drive the MOSFET gates properly. But it's more like a detail. So this is how the setup looks in reality. It's quite messy. You can see the MOSFETs are directly soldered to the board, and therefore a little bit hard to see in that picture. But and as the voltage seemed to be a little bit too unstable, so the SCS would not boot anymore, we re-added a very small capacitor, 10 microfarad ceramic capacitor, you can see it here. And to make this convenient, we soldered our so-called glitch connector to the board and provides us direct access to the SPI flash as well as to the gates of the MOSFETs. Yeah, the whole setup looks like this. We will see it in action in some minutes. And this is how the voltage drop looks like. In this attack, we can adjust two parameters, the delay until we trigger the voltage drop, and the voltage drop duration. And to find a good duration parameter, we played around while watching the boot log, and if the duration is too short, the voltage drop has no effect at all. But if the duration is too long, the target always resets. So this gives us a brute forcible range for the duration parameter. But we still don't know when we have to trigger the glitch. And to find out when the hash comparison of the root CA happens, we will have a look at the UART and SPI boot trays. So the first four signals here are SPI, and the fifth one is UART. As you can see, it first says, hey, I'm SCS, I'm booting now. And if we scroll a little bit to the left, it says got root. There it says got root CA, and it also says root CA OK. And then the normal boot process just continues. But if we modify the root CA now, the SES will report that it got the root CA, so it was loaded correctly. But it also says that the root CA hash mismatches. And we also see that the boot process doesn't continue because there's less SPI activity right here. And inspecting that SPI activity revealed that the header of bootloader 1 is not loaded when the root CA is modified. And knowing this, we can tell that the root CA hash comparison must take place during this red dotted time window here. This is about 230 microseconds long. That's pretty long, but it's still brute forceable, and that's exactly what we did next. So on the bottom, you can see the SPI chip select signal and our red dotted time window. The Teensy will starts counting at this rising edge right here. So the delay parameter also starts right there. And we flashed the original image with an unmodified root CA and started a brute force search. And while we did that, we also observed the boot log. And we found out that depending on the parameters, we get different results. The green arrows here stand for the message failed to calculate hash, which probably means that we are trying too early because we first have to compute the hash before we can compare it to something else. And yeah, then there's this orange cluster that stands for check root CA failed, which seems to be a validation procedure which takes place too late. But then there is this blue cluster right here that stands for the message root CA hash mismatch. And as we are working with the unmodified image, we might just glitch the correct hash comparison check. So those parameters are looking most promising, and we will try that next. So, yeah, we tried for 2 weeks without a single success until I found out that I was using a development Teensy firmware where I fixed a typo. But in the script that evaluates the attempts, the typo still existed. So, my... So my pull request is still pending for more than 10 months now. If you see Niklas, please tell him to merge it and also fix that script. So yeah, after figuring out this problem, we had a working attack. So let's have a look at this demo. On the top left, you will see our glitch script. Right next to it, you will see the complete setup in action. On the bottom left, there's the SSH console. And on the bottom right, you will see the UART boot log of the main course. Okay, so I just started that glitch script. This takes some seconds, but on the oscilloscope on the right side, you can see now all the different voltage drops we inject. And after a short while, we should see a successful glitch attempt. There it is. On the power supply on the right side, you can see that the power consumption of the whole board is rising. And after a while, we see the boot log of the main course. And I think now it says Ethernet is up. And we can try to log in via SSH. So now we are on that system. It's a Linux system, and we are root. So we also measured the success rate for one SOC. On average, we get a successful glitch every 2 seconds, which is quite amazing for this type of attack. Okay, so next, Niklas will talk about autopilot internals and data extraction.
So, thank you, Niklas. I think after all of the testing, your PR is finally able to merge, ready to merge. And yeah, also thank you for being the driving force behind this hack. So yeah, speaking of driving, the autopilot uses lots of data for its driving. So next to the camera data, there's also CAN bus data and the state of the autopilot's machine learning models and so on. And of course, this data is a treasure trove for training and performance evaluation of the autopilot. So the issue is that this data cannot all be saved to a 30 gigabyte universal flash storage, and it can't all be uploaded. And that's why Tesla only uploads selected snapshots of data. And this snapshot process looks as follows. So first of all the incoming data is temporarily held in ring buffers, which is essentially a cache for the last couple of seconds or minutes of data. And then this data is also constantly monitored for interesting events, for example, an airbag deployment, and these events can then cause a snapshot to be triggered. Once triggered, the snapshot then consists or starts with examining a little bit of past data and some future data that comes in, filters this data, packages it, and saves it temporarily until it can be uploaded. In the case of timing critical things like a crash video or something that's uploaded as fast as possible via the mobile data, for training data, the Tesla will wait for a Wi-Fi connection to be available. And yeah, after uploading, this data is then deleted. And yeah, in theory, this should solve the issues nicely. So first of all, we'll look at the trigger and filtering mechanism for these snapshots. So on the nicely organized autopilot file system, it was easy to find this triggers.sqlite database, which holds the actual definitions for when a snapshot should be triggered in a custom JSON format and also some metadata about these snapshots. So ordered alphabetically, we'll go through some examples. For example, the automatic emergency braking triggers here in the first place, which, yeah, trigger when there's an automatic emergency braking event and basically record all data and upload it to the cloud. Then there's here a generic trip log, which logs things like GPS positions and routing information about your trip, but it seems to be off by default, which is not what we heard from other Tesla hackers. So this is a little bit confusing still. Then we have a bunch of image and video triggers, which seem to collect data for the machine learning. And yeah, for example, if you overrode the fully self-driving with a harsh braking event, then this might collect video data so that Tesla can know what the autopilot is doing wrong. And then this last category here are pings, which basically only collect metadata not any video or CAN bus data. For example, here we seem to have an ELK test, I think. As it turns out, ELK stands actually for emergency lane keep, and this trigger will upload some metadata about when this feature was activated. We'll take a little closer look at this JSON metadata. So this is the automatic emergency braking system, which is concerned with your safety, and this vulnerable road user snapshot trigger is probably important for myself because I usually ride a bike or walk. And however, after looking at these conditions, I don't feel that safe anymore because the Tesla seems to classify myself as a threat to the Tesla autopilot. Okay, next in this JSON, then we have the definition of what data is recorded. In this case, a lot of streaming data. You can see here that it basically takes the camera data in compressed and in raw form. And then later on in the JSON file, there's also lots of metadata, notably here, whether or not it was a pedestrian or bicycle that threatened the car. And in this case, also whether the driver, for example, braked or what speed the vehicle was going at. All right, then next let's look at the upload mechanism for these snapshots. On the autopilot, we have a proxy service called Hermes that's responsible for communicating with Tesla's servers. It builds up an encrypted and authenticated connection to multiple Tesla endpoints, so the internet and even other car components can't drop in on this connection. Usually, when we make such a connection to a server, only the client, so your browser, verifies the server. But in this case, also the server verifies the client, and Hermes uses an onboard key for that authentication. All other components, so for example, the upload of the telemetry of the triggers, of the final snapshots, actually then proxies through this connection to Tesla servers. Another system is the X1 connection, which seems to be responsible for Tesla's learning functionality on the spot, because what the X1 client, for example, does, it updates label weights, which we assume is updating the machine learning models here. And it also can update the triggers for the trigger mechanism we just looked at. And actually, it can update something called the fleetconfig.yaml file, which also holds the infamous Elon mode. So in theory, this service should be able to enable or disable Elon mode on your Tesla. Coming back to the authentication, without the sport key, we can't connect to Tesla Autopilot's API. Here you can see a 400 permission denied error. But we are root on the system, so we can just copy off the key. But it turns out this key is actually encrypted and can only be used if you load it into the security subsystem to decrypt it. And so the security subsystem on the Tesla chip actually then kind of acts like a TPM. So it handles the key for you, lets you use the key, but you can't access the key material directly. However, since we are root on this security subsystem as well, we are still able to extract it. And you can see that we were able to turn this 400 permission denied error into a 404 not found error, because we didn't reverse engineer the API endpoints too much here. But still, we were able to connect to Tesla's servers as an autopilot. OK, lastly, we need to look at... Oh, thank you. So now that we looked at the cloud connection, only the temporary storage and snapshot deletion remains. So first, we did find many snapshots on our Autopilot file system, but it turns out nothing interesting, because during our testing, we've booted the Autopilot often, and it turns out every time we boot, the Autopilot reports many error messages in the forms of snapshots. So our file system is full of snapshots of error messages, but no interesting video data, because there were some snapshots taken earlier in its life, but all of these were long uploaded and deleted. Of course, deleting a file doesn't get rid of the data immediately. Only if the actual disk space where this file remained is overwritten does this data disappear. And so we were able to recover some data from the Autopilot storage. And yeah, thank you FFmpeg for knowing this video format. And now it's time to grab some popcorn, because we're going to look at the recovered video data. So here you can see 7 of the 8 camera angles, as well as some CAN data we recovered. In the middle is the CAN data, and on top you can see the speed, and then the pedal positions and the steering. And we also recovered some GPS data for this particular snapshot. You can see the video material is a bit broken, and it's probably because of some recovery errors, or maybe because this video format is still not so well implemented in FFmpeg. Probably this unconventional lane change that you might have seen here caused the trigger to be taken. In this case, actually, the fully self-driving was not active, but it seems that Tesla was still interested in this data for training. What we showed today is that with a voltage fault injection attack, Tesla's intellectual property could be threatened. But our talk, our attack also enabled third parties to analyze the system, like Kevin talked about in his last presentation. This can be of public interest, for example, for privacy or security analysis, forensic investigations. However, as the security of the system is otherwise pretty good, this research like this might become much harder in the future if such attacks are mitigated. We would like to thank a person called Green. If you don't know him, he's the Tesla hacker out there, and he helped us a lot with the hardware and some insights into the system. And we hope that we can return some favor in the form of this jailbreak to him. And yeah, if you're hooked now, then we recommend that you follow Green on one of his social media accounts, where you can find many more details about these Tesla cars. Okay, that was our talk. Thank you, Niklas, and thank you, Christian. Yeah, also thanks to a small Berlin store called Segor, which provided many last-minute parts for our attack. You. Thank you.
Yo, thanks to the three of you. There is a little bit of time for a couple of questions. Anybody interested in some information, or let's have a look at the internet first. Is there? Yeah, there is something. Please go ahead.
Yeah, there is a question from the internet. It looks like this is a hacking gaming console in car form. And the question is how expensive is it to get those boards you were hacking?
Yeah, so actually, we didn't buy any of these boards ourselves. They were all provided by friends to us. But yeah, you are able to buy them off of eBay. I think it's around 400 euros or something like that.
Yeah, the whole board computer is about, I think, in Germany from a scrapyard, I think 600 euros, 800, something like this.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Microphone number one in the front here.
Hi, I got two questions. It's about the fault injection setup. And the first one is, how do you decide to which CPU you're going to glitch? Because on the PCB board, there are two turbo CPU, right?
You mean which one of the two nodes? Or yeah.
Which one you glitch?
It doesn't matter. You can glitch both. I just started with the one that I don't know. It was random.
because the regulator chip, both chip have their own regulator chip, right? So they put the same code.
Yeah, they run the same code. They the electrical parts are all the same. You can apply the full attack on both nodes exactly the same.
Okay. And the second question is about you said you try when you're trying to glitch the CPU, you remove the capacitor and the regulator down, and it's boot failed, right?
Yeah, you need a little bit of capacitance so that the SCS still boots, but you can remove most of the other capacitors. I'm not sure if that will work in all scenarios. I mean, if it's in a car and the temperature is too low, maybe it's not working anymore. But for this lab setup, it's working.
Okay, so...
Thanks. I'm sorry. We have a couple of more people here in the queue. So. Microphone number three, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi. Great talk, thanks. So would a random delay before, during, or after the check have mitigated the attack, or do you have other means of finding out when to start the glitch?
It would definitely make it harder, and we might have to employ some different tactics to find the exact time point when to inject. So there could be side channels, for example, on the power trace that you can use for generating triggers. But yeah, this would definitely make it much harder. Even though, I mean, with the 2-second wait time, this might not add too much of a weight. But yeah, if any countermeasure would definitely make it harder, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, back to microphone number one.
Yes, thank you for your great talk. I just wonder, you said at the beginning the hash of the root CA is being checked with the hash which is baked in into the chip. Is this hash really baked in? So that means any existing Tesla cannot exchange to root CA, and when it runs out, it has basically a kill switch.
Yeah, the hash is stored in fuses. I see no way to change it or modify it. So I guess, yeah, you can't change the root CA.
But it doesn't have an expiry date, does it? That's what your question was going to.
I'm not sure.
We haven't seen a date in there. At least we didn't recognize it.
Yeah.
So it should run for a while. I guess Tesla would have thought about that. Yeah. Good question.
Okay. I see nobody lined up except for microphone number one. Last question, please.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. Do you know how the cutting of power interrupts the process of checking the certificate? Or how is that done?
You mean what exactly happens?
Yes.
We don't really know. I think some instruction is skipped or something like this, but yeah, it's hard to find out.
You could try to do some, we could do some tests now, executing test loops and so on, but since the attack already works, we're not too interested in that anymore. I don't even exactly know which kind of ARM core is the STS or something. There might even be some work already out there, but we haven't looked into it.
Thank you, anyways.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you again.